Welcome to the Elemental Awakening.
Hey guys, I'm G. Welcome to the Elemental Awakening podcast show, where I like to interview or talk to people I find interesting from all different walks of life. And I don't even know. Joey is like more like a dancer, crawler, acrobat, maybe, what do they call that? Like parkour type, rolling through life.
I like that.
He's just moving, grooving, being himself. That's what I love the most about, I think, about Joey, is that he's not afraid to express himself in whatever way sort of comes out of the moment. For example, he showed up today with a cat mask. He rides a bike around, and I just think he's an interesting guy. So anyways, welcome.
Thank you, bro.
Thank you for being here. We've had some good to be here. Very interesting conversations over the years. We met a few years ago. I was in the middle of my 55-day fast. Mm-hmm. He ended up coming on a retreat center. We got to know each other a bit more, and we've been friends ever since. Mm-hmm. So tell us a bit about like your story. You've been interesting, I guess, upbringing compared to the upbringing that I know growing up in suburbia. You know, you grew up in...
Well, 8 to 19, I was in Texas.
8 to 19, Texas.
And then before that, I moved every 2 years of my life. But I think you're referring to... pretty sure you're referring to... I grew up as a Mormon.
Yeah.
And...
A moving Mormon. Tell me about that. You're moving... Was it a military thing? Or
like, my dad had different jobs, actually. Jobs. Yeah, yeah. Just have us moving a lot, basically. Yeah, yeah.
Okay. So where do you want to start the journey? Tell us a bit about yourself. Yeah,
a bit about myself. I could go, you know, anywhere. I grew up as a Mormon. I mean, a bit about myself. I think of what's like the first thing that I think of. It's kind of like the first memory that seems really significant in my life, honestly, is my little sister passing away.
Oh shit.
When I was like 3.5 years old. I really specifically remember that night really, really well. And I think that kind of like did instigate this like search for like, what the hell is going on here? You know, I think as a kid, I remember the sirens, the lights, very small. And me wondering like, I know my mom's going crazy. And I was like, what's going on? This neighbor picked me up. I was like, everybody tells me I spoke really, really well as a kid. And so I think it's probably true that this, anyways, the neighbor picked me up and I was like, what's happening? And he was like, your sister. And he was like, you know, she got sick. And I was like, I remember being like, poor guy, like what's wrong with him? Like, when people get, she's just going to the doctor. You know, as a kid, like I didn't think they had this concept of that people could like just disappear or something like that, you know? And so, it felt like I remember being like, huh, this guy doesn't understand. And then I remember him, he looked like, oh shit, you know, like, what do I even say? You know? And so I think like that.
Was it an accident or was it like immediate or was it like, was she sick or you don't have to share if you don't feel
better? Yeah, it was sudden infant death syndrome. And if you know, like, which people have opinions about, but like that make people who have had that happen upset. Mm-hmm. People's opinions about SIDS can make people who have had that happen to their children very upset. I'm speaking for my mother. Love you, Janet. and so my mom's a nurse, you know, so it doesn't always have to do with what they think it has to do. Basically, SIDS is the cover-all diagnosis for a baby died and we don't know why. Suddenly, it just died. We're not sure why. There could be some reasons for asphyxiation that have to do with the way you place the baby, but my mom is a nurse, and so I feel emotional actually talking about that, because she's very sensitive about that.
Mm. Well, thank you for sharing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So
mostly I just feel emotional for my mother. I know it's, because I don't really explain that way, that whole like dynamic of her. She's very defensive about that. Of course, right?
Yeah, of course. I can't imagine what that experience could be like from a parent. Having kids of my own, it breaks my heart hearing about it.
Yeah.
From like, I think about my son, if that would happen to my daughter. So seeing how you would sort of have that experience, and thinking about my wife, like how hard and difficult that would be, even just to bounce back for something like that for your other kids, and like what that could be like. So talk about starting deep on the podcast, just to get right into it. Jeez.
So that like, you know, acquaintance with death kind of early, I think, did have me be like lots of like, you know, very interested in what's going on somehow.
These existential questions about, you know, like what is life and what's going on.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
As a child, to think about that.
Even like with the current situation, you know, the virus, like when it first started, like the reason I took it seriously is because I was like, those images of the 1918 Spanish flu were what I thought was going to happen in some ways. Eventually I was like, shit, people are taking this really seriously. And since I believe that might have happened, I believe it might happen again. Mm-hmm. You know, I recognize that there could be fuckery. Am I allowed to say that word?
Yeah, sure.
With like history, actually, I recognize that I don't really believe what I think I believe totally, but that I kind of do actually. That maybe it could be true. And so, like this the fact that it's death. Like for me, with the coronavirus, one thing I think we mentioned nonviolent communication, which would be great when we were off camera, as something to put into culture somehow. Very intentionally, helpfully. Another thing is like, hey, we're all dying, you know, like this, let's remind ourselves that this is a funeral, you know, like, and like, this is a good opportunity for us to all have compassion for one another. Even if we think that because like right now, technically we're closer than 6 feet, you know? And like, I'm just to be blunt, you know, like, oh, I'll put it this way. I had a friend who on Easter, his mother picked him up to go to her house to eat dinner, and they zoomed in her daughter, and the daughter was mad because the mother and the son were sitting close to one another, and he was like, "Well, she picked me up from the car. Like, we're not going to separate now." And she's like, oh. "Like," and she hung up. Bo was my friend. My friend was like, he was like, "You," he's like, "the problem with." Your will, when you want it to control other people, is that's when you're going to get lots of problems. Your will's fine for you, but when you want it to control other people is when you'll get problems. And, you know, and he started to kind of, and she got mad, preach. And I thought, you know, that's true. And it's kind of bold and helpful to say, but sort of another thing to say humbly is to say like, look, we're all gambling. You know, we don't really know. Like if the fact that because you're following the orders, the economy turns terrible and 10 million people die because of you, like, I forgive you. You didn't know. You were trying the best. And if, because I happen to not, you know, stay in for 3 months, I go, you know, there's some people who haven't gone out their doors for 3 months. Yeah. And they might think that because of me, there's 5,000 extra dead people. Well, and I'm sorry. Actually, it's not my fault. Birth was their fault, you know, and so, you know, like, in some way. And even if I did sort of contribute, like, forgive me, like we're all trying our best. Mm. Like this compassionate way of looking, I like that, you know?
Yeah, it's hard to say, like, is this thing even working? There's certain countries that didn't even close their borders, and apparently they're doing fine. And,
yeah,
you know, it's, you know, I've been over, as I get older, questioning more and more of what the media is telling me, because you catch them saying things that are not true. And, you know, like the biggest one for me goes back to, I think, the biggest first eye-opener was the weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. When it was like certain, and I was just like, these guys, like, get them, they're the bad guys.
Yeah.
They lied about it openly, they got caught.
Yeah.
Nothing happened to them.
Yeah.
You know, that not that I could see, but it was mm-hmm. like, wow, they have the power to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So then ever since then, I've questioned everything, you know. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I'm probably way wrong. Maybe 99% of the time I'm telling the truth.
Yeah.
But there's still that inkling of a doubt in the back of my mind. Like, what if there's something we're not being told here?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, because you see the people talking about how social isolation leads to increased depression, suicide,
mm-hmm.
Abuse in the home,
yeah.
Lowered immune systems.
Yeah.
You know, like, now, you know, like, I don't know, but are there people looking at, hey, what's the long-term death rate of this versus, you know, what's COVID? And, you know, I don't really want to get into in this talk about statistics and stuff like that, but just that whole questioning aspect of, like,
yeah.
Hey, what's really going on here? So, anyways, let's get back to your
my story,
your sharing here. So,
oh, okay.
So it spurs you on this path of asking questions, and you're moving around a lot, meeting new people, getting uprooted, rerooted.
Yeah, lots.
You
know, lots
I think
of that.
That probably sort of is what helped you be such a social, open person. That's
mm-hmm. yeah, yeah, yeah. yeah.
Say so.
That had some effect.
Yeah. So mm-hmm. tell me. So like how? I guess what I'm getting at. Is over your story, what started leading you more to become the person you are today? Are you always this kind of joy, open, spiritual seeker type person?
I think even when I was, you know, like I was in the game of Mormonism, and
explain what that means.
Meaning, like when I say the game, I think like religions are somewhat kind of like language games and behavior games to some degree or another. I was born into that context, and I did like I said, I think that we're all kind of like gambling on something or betting on someone. And I took the bet that my culture gave me that, like, it says the most thing that you want to do, the best thing that you can accomplish is to find out that the church is true. That's the one thing you want to know. And the worst thing that you can do is lose that knowledge. So I worked really hard to believe and to know within that context of that. In some ways, like, man, this is really vulnerable again. Like,
share what you feel comfortable.
I'm just thinking in regards to like the effect that the death seemed to have on my parents was such that, well, I think when I was a kid, I thought at some point that it was my job to not upset my mom, basically. Like, I was just supposed to make sure and not upset her, because I could tell, like, she was really upset. And I think I recognized that, like, at some point, it feels kind of vague, but, like, sort of there, like, I was like, oh, like, I'm an extra burden to this person who I love, who's having a lot of trouble, you know?
Mm.
And I was like, you know, like, don't upset her. My job is to not upset her.
Not to be yourself and have a child, it's just to not upset.
Yeah. And to be a good kid, you know? And, you know, and so in some ways it was like a emotional husband or something, you know, a bit for my mother. And I think because my sister died, like, just being very much overprotected within my family. And religion, in some ways, you could call it overprotective already.
Mm.
I don't think they would appreciate hearing that, but there's some things they wouldn't appreciate hearing that I don't want to say.
Mm-hmm.
There's some things I'm okay.
Okay.
But just, you know, like, my comfort level of my willingness to speak the truth in their face, even though I love them, is getting bigger, but still I care, you know. You got to take, you can't just speak what you want to say to everybody.
Are you still feeling that feeling even right now of not upsetting your mother?
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah. And I know that, like, it's like important for me to expand that boundary. For me, it is.
I'm not a psychologist in any way, but I think that once you start to identify these patterns, that sort of understand that it's okay. It's not your fault.
Yeah.
You know, and it's okay to sort of express yourself in the way that is freeing and not based on a belief pattern that's within you.
Or not worried that, like, well, what if, you know, because they all identify so much with their culture. If I talk about their culture, you know, it's like hurting them.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, I know that's not my intention. So it's an odd thing to have to deal with. So anyways, I bet on the church hardcore. You know, I was a Mormon missionary for 2 years in Russia. And
so that's going, trying to
convert people
to the... So what's it like being a Mormon? Like how different...
A missionary? Or
just a Mormon in general? Mormon, like, they believe in Jesus?
Yeah, it's a Christian church.
In
that they believe that Jesus was a dude 2,000 years ago, got hung on the cross, suffered for all our sins, and if you believe in that, then he pays the price. He goes to jail for us or something like that. Or he suffered the pain of our guilt or something like that. So in that way, they're very Christian. They're not exactly Christian in some other ways. So I have some interesting sort of sci-fi beliefs. This is an interesting belief. I consider it a sci-fi belief. I think it's really cool, actually. They say that our God was once a man on a planet somewhere who became a god. So as God is, man may be. And as man is, God once was. That's how they say it.
Hmm.
So, like, we are here, the Mormons believe that we're here to get married to a woman if we're a man if we're a woman, and then create, like, spirit children and create cosmoses.
So you have your own planet.
You'll create your own.
Is that, like, after you die?
If you've lived a good life, and even if you're not a Mormon, but if in the afterlife or the spirit world you accept Mormonism and then learn the principles of the universe, that eventually you can grow to be your own God.
Wow.
It's kind of it's
interesting.
Yeah.
Very interesting.
And Jesus is there too somehow.
You gotta always throw Jesus in there for good measure.
Yeah.
The ultimate validator. It's a religion. It's Christian.
Yeah.
You think they might have put that in there just to protect themselves?
No, it's definitely very Christian-centric. Like, some of those philosophies that I... Like, you know, all religions...
Like, a lot of the teachings are Christian-based?
Hardcore, yeah. I mean, very, very much, you know.
Is it... do they believe in polygamy?
They were... it was kind of founded on that. Not quite right away, but it's like some years into it, it became a thing. And now the official church is against it. The official church's stance is
split.
That... Yeah, if you practice it, you will be excommunicated officially. Hmm. But there are people who are like, no, we're staying with the way, you know.
Interesting.
So yeah, being a Mormon like requires you to for instance, like not speak about it the way I'm speaking about it. That's for sure.
This is a big thing right now, talking about.
Well, yeah.
Speak about it in general, or speaking about it
in ways that they don't want you to talk about it. Like, you make promises to not speak poorly of the Lord's anointed, you know?
I don't think you said that speaks poorly of them.
Well, I'll try right now. I love you, Lord's anointed. I'll speak poorly of that law on itself, you know, to have it be a law that you can't speak bad about me is like just so fishy, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, so anyways, the way I came to be, I would say, you know, like I, as a Mormon missionary, it's like 2 years of, it's weird, the dynamics, because it's like because I was overprotected, being a missionary was like the only avenue available to me, I think. Like, I wasn't really allowed to get work as a kid. I wasn't allowed to clean the house. It would become an upset. I was kind of in retarded class, basically, and put on pills and stuff. And I wasn't allowed to play sports, even. It was, again, an overprotection of my mom, just to be honest. And I love her, but that's kind of sad for us and for her a little bit. That I think that, yeah, at one point we actually talked about it, and she admitted it. She said she felt real bad about that.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, I don't want you to feel bad, you know? I really don't, you know? But it put a kid, like a young man, to be that... it was church or my room almost, you know. And there was lots of activities in church. Church provided a lot of people that would take me camping, you know, some mm-hmm. sort of mentorship and stuff like that. But there was a lot of, you know, you're going to go on a mission, you're going to do that. And I think I recognize now that if I hadn't gone on a mission, the option was basically to have my life fall apart. And I noticed that people who didn't, that happened to them.
Mm-hmm.
There was no cultural support, and I would have no like foundation. I hadn't, you know, I hadn't worked before, really. Mm-hmm. You know, it would be like, where would I go? Yeah. What would I do? So they were like, they interview you. Do you believe in this? Do you not do that? Do that? Do you drink alcohol? Do you even stupid? Do you masturbate? You know, they don't want you to ever do that. That's for sure.
Straight to hell.
Worthiness interviews. I hate that word. Worthiness interview. What a stupid word. That's me. Hey, Lord's anointed, listen to that. I feel like I want to give you my middle finger. Live long and prosper. Read between the lines. worthiness interviews. I was preparing for a minute. Do you believe in this? I'm like, well, I'm trying. I was honest. I was like, I'm trying to. But I don't know, to tell you, that, you know, like, pretend that you're like the... And I'm like, but I'm not sure, really. You know? Like, and then they would say, well, it was funny. They would do that. They'd be very sincere. Let's pretend that you're me. My last name's Lundgren, so I'm the guy who's in. I'm like, Brother Lundgren. I pause for dramatic effect. I testify to you. Pause for dramatic effect. That if you will go out and serve the people and testify to them, that you know this is true, that you will come to a knowledge of the truthfulness of it for yourself. So there's this idea of like the way a testimony or the way a testimony is born is by bearing it. So the way to know that the church is true is to tell people you believe it's true. You could hear someone else tell you it's true, and the Spirit could say, oh, what they said is true. But they say the Spirit that confirms with you that it's easier to tell it to you when you tell it to the other person. So for 2 years, it was kind of like, I was like experimenting. And like every once in a while, I would be like, I would kind of have a bit of breakdown. I'd be like, what am I doing? You know, like every few months.
How old are you at the time?
I was 19, 20, 21. And I was honestly sometimes praying I was in Russia the whole time, and sometimes I was praying like, I want to fall on the ice. And like, I was having a good time, but there was turmoil too, you know, and it was really, really helpful. One of the things that made me very social, because you're forced to constantly be, you know, told no and
conversion. So like, what was your conversion rate? Did you have like a funnel where you'd like warm them up and invite them over for tea, and then you'd sort of pitch them a little bit, or was it straight like...
Yeah, yeah, actually, good point. I never thought of that as a funnel, but...
Well, I'm into internet marketing these days, so I'm sort of like looking at how
it is a good business, eh? It's a good business model.
Yeah.
You know? I'm a salesperson for the Mormon Church. Hey, it's only 10% of your income, that's all.
They have to sort of like...
That's a commitment that they make to become 10%. A Mormon.
Okay. Yeah. What's the upside? What's the selling feature?
Well, you get to like...
Your own planet,
you get
the universe?
Yeah. That's pretty good. So, and like...
For only 10%?
3 hours of church on Sunday. 3 whole hours. For only 10% every Sunday, you get that. For only 10% of your income.
Oh, you get it.
Yeah, you get it. Okay. And you can't speak poorly of the Lord's anointed, which is nice. For only 10% of your income, you can't speak poorly of these guys, you know? It's like Bill Gates. Don't say anything bad about him. You better not.
You said it. Now we gotta take off this whole podcast.
Yeah.
The bots are coming.
You can't, like the other word you can't say? The My Sharona?
Yeah.
The My Sharona Cyrus?
Yeah.
So
you're in Russia, you're learning.
Oh, the funnel, skills. The funnel.
And was it a lot of people like coming over, like especially in Russia? Because was it like a target because they're not very religious?
No, they send people all over the world. There's countries where the churches, where the missionaries are very successful. A lot of South America, they're very successful. Like tons of baptisms or conversions, and I probably about once a month on average or something like that. The funnel in my mission specifically was we didn't really knock much doors. We talked to random people, and one of the biggest things they told us to do if you don't have investigators or, you know, people that are checking it out, is to advertise for free English lessons. So we taught free English with ultimately the purpose to teach the gospel.
Oh, that's a lead magnet.
Yeah. And we would do it pretty professionally, though. You know, we would say, hey, if they'd ask us questions, because often they'd be like, they've never seen an American, and they'd be like, wait, you're teaching us free English, and your name says, you have this name tag? It says you're an old man, because they call Mormons or the missionaries elder, and then their last name. And they took that name, that word from the Bible, and people don't know this word from the Bible in Russian. It's stari, which is old, and shina is person. So it looks like it says like old man Lundgren or something like that.
19-year-old.
Yeah. And it says something about Jesus, and I'm like teaching them free English in a funny accent. They've never met an American, so often they'll be like, "Wait, what are you doing here?"
What's the catch here?
Yeah, and so we, you know, our professional play was, and it's smart to do, it's respectful too, it's like, hey, we came here to teach English, we can talk about that afterwards, do you mind if we finish the lesson? And we said we would only do 10 so that people wouldn't like keep us too long, but if we thought there was a strategy is that if we thought they were, you know, interested and that it would just take a little longer, we'd be like, hey, normally we only do 10, but we like hanging out with you, can we do 4 more?
Free bonus.
Yeah, exactly, because we know that there's some, like,
they knew the whole internet marketing drip before it was even
exactly this. There's a reason process. That Mormons are very good entrepreneurial people, and they
set up the sales process.
Yeah, they do. There's a reason that lots of salespeople come and recruit from BYU, because, and that multi-level marketing companies come from Mormonism, you know, in a big, big way.
So you did that, and then you found your way. So how did you get sort of out of that and find your way to Toronto? You know, like when I met you, you were running at the time, I guess, the only ganja-friendly yoga studio in the city. I was like, who is this guy?
Yeah. So after the mission, and in some ways I really loved the mission just because it was really easy, because you always knew exactly what to do. Like, wake up at this time, be out the door at this time, do this. And it was always kind of like, whatever social forces there are of expectations, I knew I was basically doing them. It was kind of relaxing in some ways. And coming back, it was like a whole world of choice again. That was kind of rough in some ways. So anyways, I went to BYU, the Mormon University, and somewhere in there I had a heart surgery. I think it was like in my maybe second and a half year or third year, I had heart surgery, 3.5 cups of extra fluid in the heart. I like to say my heart was too big. It's cute, a funny thing, but
3.5 extra cups in the heart?
Yeah, of the pericardium, so that's the sac around the heart. So it was putting pressure on everything around and the heart itself. And that was really intense experience for a lot of different reasons. And after that, I recognized that my testimony was, I was like, I almost died, and I'm really not sure about this church thing. So for a little while, I tried even harder, just to be even more Mega Mormon man, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I was asked to give a talk in church, and I was like, I'll do it. And as I began to prepare, it felt like the desk I was on broke and everything was glass. And I was like, oh shit, like, I don't believe this. And I ran. I was in an apartment. It was a summer job. We had the master suite in the room, me and my roommate, and there was a bathroom. Locked the door, turned the fan on, ran through the bathroom into the closet, closed the closet so there'd be a sound barrier. And I was like, I just went like, ah! Like a just really, really loud yell. Like really intense, because I don't know people that aren't Mormon, really, you know? Like, I mean, I do, but I don't really have friends with people that aren't Mormon very much. In high school, I had some, but my tight group was always my Mormon friends, you know? And I don't know how to, I don't know. I know that I don't believe this. I know that I never really have at this moment. I'm willing to admit, like,
you tried your best.
I'm like, I didn't really ever believe this, you know? Like, there were times where I was like, yeah, I believe this. And it felt good because I got the confirmation. And there's these mechanisms. Like, Mormons are great at conjuring up feelings, and it's actually a cool skill. I actually converted a friend of mine. I had a friend of mine who did convert in junior high. Very, one of my best friends, and he is definitely not heterosexual, basically. So even though he's that, he converted to Mormonism, and Mormonism has a problem with that. And that's one of the things that made me question it. I was like, I love my friend. I don't really care that much about the fact that he wants to hold dude's hand. You know, like, why do I need to have a problem with him? Mm-hmm. You know, they have these smooth ways of saying it, like, don't hate the sinner, hate the sin. And I'm like, it's not a sin for him to hold somebody's hand or kiss somebody. Mm-hmm. It may be weird. Like, you know, bodies are weird, but my body with a girl's body is weird too. You know, like,
I get it.
You know, pregnancy is more of a problem than gay people in a big way. You know, pregnancy could be like way more of an issue than whatever gay people could do, you know, like, and so that was a thing. And, but he said this thing anyways about Mormonism that he liked that I gave it to him, was this ability to conjure up feelings within himself. He said, I didn't know about like this feeling of the spirit. Mm. He goes, but y'all, the Mormons know that, you know, it's kind of used for their own purposes, but, so anyways, yeah, I had a heart surgery, and I was like, you know, I ran into the closet. Eventually, I did call my mother, and, you know, I really love my mom, actually. I really, really, really do think she's a really sweet person, and that she's a very nervous person, too, and I say this with love towards her, but she's nervous, for sure, and at times, she's very funny at times, but I didn't even know what to say to her. I just didn't know what to do. I called her, and she could hear me breathing, basically, and she's like, Joseph, you okay? She's like, can tell something's wrong. You can tell me anything. And I was like, you know, I could. And finally, I just yelled it at her, basically, you know. I don't believe this is stupid. Joseph, calm down. Like, nicely trying to calm me down, of course, you know. And then she did say something that kind of, you know, but don't you want to get married in the temple? And definitely at this point in my life, I was definitely like girl crazy, you know, like early 20s, young man, 20s, young man. Like, that got me because I knew I didn't know how to like interact with women that weren't Mormons in some ways. And it made me really angry because it almost felt like, you got me, like, and I yelled at her. I was like, fine, when I'm in the temple, know that I lied to everybody on my way there, you know, because like I really didn't see, like, oh my God, like, what am I going to do about that, you know? And poor woman, like, she didn't deserve this, you know, she wasn't being like, you know, she's a nice woman, but obviously also, like, it's a lot of energy, dude. Where do you put it, you know? So then from then on, it was like a slowly, like, how do I take all this off, you know, like, Jesus fucking Christ, get off of here, you know, like, oh man, it was a really long process, and, you know,
you're in Texas at this time?
That was in Utah. The heart surgery was in Utah.
How did you get to Toronto? Like, how did the full break happen from that whole situation?
Yeah,
Or was Toronto not the first place that you left?
Well, I left from Texas to Russia for 2 years, went back to Texas. My parents are still in Texas. Went to university in Utah. Spent a few summers different places for jobs. And then I was in Utah when I had the heart surgery, and was in Atlanta for a summer job when that happened, when the break happened. And then like, Mormons wear a special set of undergarments, and so, for instance, like, it took me a while to be able to take those off, not because I was afraid to, but because of the socialness of them, you know, like, you'd be able to see, like, the line on your pants, whether you're wearing them or not, and to tell you the truth, when it came to dating girls, like, it's a thing. If you're dating Mormon girls and they don't see that line, they have like some judgment of you.
And wow, so psychology between pajamas.
Yeah. So I started telling people in a way that was more like asking them questions, you know, like if I was on a date with a girl, hey, do you ever have doubts or anything like that? You know, like,
are you trying to find another defector that would come with you and run away?
Yeah, or, you know, trying to also not pretend so much. Like, I don't want to lead somebody on. Yeah. I want to give them the opportunity to ask me as many questions. If they don't seem interested, then I'll just have a good time and then know that whatever. But you ever have doubts? And they'll be like, so it would depend. Sometimes they'd be like, sometimes, or sometimes they'd be like, no, not really, like, or whatever. When I was 14, I had this experience. Ever since then, whatever they say, it might, may or may not be true. It kind of is true, even if it's sort of not. Basically, I would always kind of turn it into an opportunity to just say something like, well, you know, I certainly do. Like, I'm glad for the church that we have and the resource, the benefits it gives to us, the teachings, the community. But I know I certainly have my doubts at times. And even that's not something that people say, really, you know.
So was there anything that, like super positive that you took in from a spiritual perspective from your experience with Mormonism? Or do you think it actually was more to push you in the direction that you're going now because you didn't align with it?
I'm definitely a product of Mormonism in a big way. And a lot of the, what I would call maybe like cute, nice, thinking of others, comes from that culture, you know. Like the other day they have their general conference, which is twice a year, and I was just showing my roommates it happened to be on, they broadcast it, and it's just basically a lot of the information is like the kind of information that a good grandpa would give you, and that's really you know, if you have it has a nice influence on you. The Mormonism added that kind of like innocence, niceness sort of to me, and it has that influence on me, combined with my mom. I grew up in a daycare at my house. Mm-hmm. So in a way I say I didn't have a job, but I always had a job, actually. Yeah. I was always playing with little kids, throwing them in the air, giving them bottles, playing piano for them, making them laugh, scaring them, tickling them. So this thing's definitely, in some ways people ask me, do you still consider yourself a Mormon? And I'm like, I was born that way, you know? I'm a Mormon the same way I'm American, you know? Like, I live in Canada, but I was born an American. Mm-hmm. And I know that a lot of the stuff that the church, especially its leadership puts out, that I don't agree with it. But I was born that way, you know? Mm-hmm. Same way that I was born American, even though I'm in Canada.
So, okay, so let's move to, like, the exploration. So you end up leaving officially, sort of.
Yeah.
And then I feel like you're so contained in this worldview of Mormonism. Mm-hmm. What was coming out of that like? And then, you know, finding things like yoga, finding things like cannabis. Mm-hmm. Like, could you smoke weed as a Mormon?
No. No, nothing like that. Coffee, like, not tea, nothing.
Like ayahuasca, for the first time. Yeah. You want to explain?
Yeah.
Explain what that was like?
Well, I had decided that a lot of things that had been taught to me as like moralistic, they weren't actually moralistic. Maybe they weren't smart to do. Maybe it's not smart to do. It's like, it's not, to me, when it comes to morals, like, don't hit somebody, you know, don't lie, you know. Don't punch somebody. Yeah, like, but I thought there were certain things that I thought that maybe they weren't immoral, maybe they weren't smart, like maybe alcohol, it's not immoral, but maybe it's not smart. Mm-hmm. You know, and that maybe it could lead to depravity or something like that. I wasn't sure, so it went with that with a lot of things. You know, I said, this will be kind of oddly vulnerable, but I said I was in my room a lot, and definitely, like, there's probably a lot of people who can relate to this. This is a good thing to say. It's making me nervous, but it's okay. Is that, like, in my room there was a TV, and like I said, I wasn't allowed to play sports, and this TV, if you put it on channel 99, was scrambled porn. And
I've been there.
Hey, thank you. But with the dynamic of the church, see, this is what I'm saying. Like, don't speak poorly of the Lord's anointed. Like, right between, right? This worthiness interview stuff, you know, like, do you masturbate? Well, you know, like, yeah, I have, you know, from the time I was very young, I already had before you even asked me, you know, like, and then the messaging is, it's bad, don't do it, it's bad, if you do it, you might become a rapist and a murderer, and no good girl would want to date you, that's for sure, but we're here to help. So let's have an interview with you every week and ask you how many times, and let's say, well, you know, if you really wanted to, you could quit, and me be like, my will is not strong, you know, but like, it's a drug in a big way, you know, the same way media is a drug, it's a drug for sure, especially for a young man, and it's in my room, there's no other resource, you know, so coming out from the church, like, I had dealt with that, I would say it was with very deleterious effects in my life, compulsively. It was this guilt, shame, blame, relief from the guilt was the only, sometimes it would be the only relief, and then it would start the same cycle. Mm-hmm. And So when I left the church, I suddenly noticed that that usage just went down, like a lot down. And I just was like, I'm not even going to try to stop. I just decided that I don't have to feel guilty about it at all. Because it was like this enforced guilt.
You stop feeling guilty.
When I stopped like enforcing the guilt somehow, like there's mechanisms of enforcing the guilt within this. And I was like, I know this has like effects, but like this extra added guilt doesn't, I don't, you know. Mm. It's funny, actually, for the 2 years of my mission, I didn't masturbate once, actually. Oh, wow. I was really able to, yeah, they said I had to not do it for 2 months before. And then for a whole 2 years, there was a few times I almost like completed the mission, but you know, but never did. And then they also have the worthiness interview there. Oh, wow. You know, and I was like, I almost did. Like, so stupid, man. What an idiot. Anyways, like, so that was interesting. Immediately, you know, that problem became like so much less. And when it came to cannabis, I kind of thought that maybe I would never do it. When it came to things like meditation, I asked this ecclesiastical leader where I was as a Mormon, as a young man before high school, I would wake up basically 2 hours early to go to church every day, which is quite a big commitment. And they call that seminary. And the seminary teacher, I asked him once about meditation, and he was like, "It's a, you know, it's okay, but like, I don't recommend it." Like, isn't that funny? And same thing. I asked the bishop once. This guy told me about mushrooms in my art class. He was like, "I went to the lake and I ate mushrooms, and the world went bring." So this young man told me my age, and I was like, "What do you mean?" He's like, "It just goes like bring." And I thought, "What is that?" You know. And I asked my bishop. I was like, hey, it doesn't say anything to not eat mushrooms in this like health thing where it says not to eat this and this and this. I was like, but it doesn't say anything about that. And he was like, I think it's the spirit of the law. You shouldn't do it. Basically, he said it could interrupt my process of trying to go on a mission. So I wanted to do those things naturally. And those things started to come in as soon as I gave up on Mormonism in one way or another, especially meditation quickly. And then marijuana or cannabis came in when I fell asleep on a beach and had a really, really bad sunburn. Basically didn't sleep for like 40-something hours and was taking painkillers, sleeping pills, trying tea baths, aloe. Like, just like, the hives would get up and I'd be like, ah, you know. And so my mom is a nurse. Well, she is an unregistered nurse. She used to be a nurse. And so I called her and was like, I told her what was happening and what I, you know, what I had already taken, and she's like, "You've already took like a ton. It's like the only thing you can do now is go to the hospital and they'll give you morphine." And I was like, "That's going to be expensive, and it's morphine, you know." And I had already decided that I didn't believe that marijuana was like an immoral thing necessarily. So I called a friend of mine, and it was funny because I had lectured him about marijuana before. And I was like, "Hey." Say his name, but you know, and I was like, told him, and he's like, hold on, are you asking me if you can smoke pot with me? I was like, yeah. He goes, ask me again. He's like, this is so cool. I was like, okay, you know, like, can we do it? He's like, come over, man. You know, so we smoked a bowl, and it didn't do anything to me. And he's like, let's wait another, like, well, sometimes the first time it doesn't do anything. So, and we waited like 30 minutes and just kind of like we watched something, I guess. Probably, and then we went back and out, and as we smoked, I was like, "Wow!" And all the pain was gone. That's for sure, and it felt great. And then I didn't smoke any cannabis for quite a long while after that. I think that was my first mind-altering substance or something like that. Maybe it was something else, but I think it was that. I think I noticed a few things about that experience. Is that if people think that you shouldn't do that, that whenever you hear someone say, when a kid hears someone say, an authority say, this is bad, it's dumb, people who, they can't believe it because they know that it opens them up to things that the leader isn't willing to admit. Mm-hmm. Like, it opens you up to an ability to recognize art in different ways, music in different ways, like philosophy. Like Joe Rogan said it this way. He was like, the thing I noticed about pot smokers is that with their words, this is a really crude way to put it, they're willing to raw dog the universe. You know, they're willing to take it off and just like, they allow their mind to go places, mm-hmm. you know, that people who've only mostly, there's probably exceptions, I know there are, but people who have never allowed their mind, you know, to go towards non-linearity, they kind of have to they stay within mm-hmm. the lines or something. So I noticed that there was certainly a form of rebelliousness against everything, and I was like, I think there was this thought, like, I'm gonna prove to y'all that y'all are wrong by being awesome while doing drugs, you know.
When did things like psychedelics come into the
picture?
After that, the cannabis experience, was it like, and you're what, still early 20s at this point?
Yeah.
When did like mushrooms, LSD, ayahuasca, things like that come into the picture?
Well, I was going to this meditation group. And the teacher there was pretty cool. We'd have cool conversations, and I asked him if he'd ever done psychedelics, and he said he had. And then I just was like very interested. And then I think Terrence McKenna, I listened a lot to Terrence McKenna. And actually, I think the first potent one, the first like of like, you know, cannabis is like awesome and it's super potent and great. But the first of like the maybe true tryptamine psychedelics or something like that was ayahuasca, actually.
Oh, right.
Yeah, it was, and it happened, like, the timing of it was really...
In the Santo Daime tradition?
No,
it wasn't
down,
even...
Lay down...
it's just a ceremony.
Like, yeah, like Peruvian style. And that was amazing, you know, that was so amazing and really great, you know, initiative.
Did it change your perspective on life, that ayahuasca ceremony?
Yeah, or? Even headed into it, you know, like, on the way into it, I was like, I remember I was driving to it, and the world was already like, you know, I was like, oof, this isn't, and the way, the timing of it, you know, like how the lady who was coming at the time, and it just was like this weird kind of perfect thing, and the drive on the way there, I just saw some things that I was like, it was cool, I feel like psychedelics in some big way do open you up to recognize that your life is a fairy tale.
Mm-hmm.
That's a story, or there's some. It makes somehow.
So the ayahuasca experience sort of shifted you in a way.
Yeah,
opened your eyes to. Did any of the Mormon stuff come up in the ayahuasca? Like, this is real. This is not real.
Lots of stuff about. Oh man, like yeah. I mean, I think a lot of people have this experience where I kept asking there was like this lady's voice that was beautiful but like really stern too, and she was guiding me all over the place, these really weird worlds, and I would notice myself be like, is this real? And she would say, don't say that word. Like, not yet. You're not ready to even say such a word or something. Like, I'd be like, okay. Like, okay. And I would notice myself asking, I'd be like, wait, what is this even real? And she'd be like, hey, I told you not to even say that word. And I was like, okay. But she was like really, really lovely. And she told me at the end, like, as she kind of like went away and almost, and she was like, and I thought that that voice exactly would come up.
The open invitation.
Yeah, exactly.
And then in between, like, continuing your plant medicine, you got involved in A Course in Miracles. You found that book. How did that come up?
Yeah,
A Course in Miracles is really interesting. Those who don't know, give us a quick sort of rundown of what it's about.
Well, first off, if people ever ask me that, I like to ask them, first off, what do you think the Course in Miracles is a course in?
Miracles.
Exactly. It's a course in what?
Miracles.
Exactly. Okay, you got it. What's a miracle? Well, that's a really interesting topic. But the world says that all of perception is made of projection, and that A Course in Miracles is a change in the mind that will be reflected in perception. Mm. So you're all of, you know, you don't have to believe this thought, but this is like a whole thought system, basically. And I found that book. I mean, I love books. I love Osho. I love all the Mujis, all those people. I think they're really great. Even if whatever, excuse my French again, fuckery may be true or not, I still think there's value there, you know. Even though I got my own fuckery, but I got some value too, you know. These people
absolutely
may have it. So, but The Course in Miracles was almost like, to me, a psychedelic when I read it. Really, when I came to
read a few pages, and it's like, whoa. Like, it's like, you can only read a few pages at a time. It's not like you can pick it up and read it in a weekend.
Yeah.
So
someone
channeled it. It was apparently channeled by someone that they said it was the word of Jesus.
Yeah, the narrator claims to be... Yeah, the narrator speaks as if, or writes as if, it or he or she is like either the voice of, specifically sometimes definitely the character Jesus, you know, in the story,
mm-hmm.
and or the position of Christ or Buddha, whatever, like that sort, you know, which I kind of think those are sort of differentiated from what there's like Jesus, and that's like the name Giovanni or the name Joey,
mm-hmm.
and then there's Christ, and that's like an accomplishment or a way, a perspective.
Okay.
Gotcha. So the voice kind of speaks from both, and at times speaks as if it's sort of like the creator or and at times speaks as if it's the Holy Spirit, which by the Course's standards is the voice of your awake self who speaks to you in the dreams, in the terms of the dream that you believe in. Mm-hmm. Like we believe in the dream of English right now. This is the way the Course speaks about stuff anyways. Mm-hmm. And we believe in, like, a bus drives by and it happens to say this thing on it that the Course in Miracles says that the Holy Spirit uses the words in the book to speak to you, to teach you that in reality there's nothing other than the truth and you're fine. Instead of what the Course has, the opposite side, the ego, is trying to prove to you that pain, problem, separation, death, chaos are what's real. And the Course, so the metaphysics of the Course is that how that world of separation, pain, problem, appeared to start, or its origin story, or the creation myth of the world of appearances, is that, and it doesn't say this is true, it just says this is a helpful way of pointing, is that it says, into the mind of God, where all was one and always will be one, there crept a tiny mad idea at which it forgot to laugh. And that's how, and that, it's a beautiful little sentence, you know?
It's beautiful, it's so deep. That is a psychedelic in itself.
Yeah. And the tiny mad
idea. Can you say that one more time?
Yeah, into the mind of God, where all was one and always will be one, there crept a tiny mad idea at which it forgot to laugh. Mm-hmm. And that's how the world of pain, problem, separation. That's the Course in Miracles doesn't say it this way, but I like to put it this way. That's what started the Big Bang, basically, in some funny way. And again, this is just try this on. It may not be true. It's just an idea. Ideas have effects, and, you know, like, see if the idea has effect, or what kind of effect the idea has. That to take that meditation of the origin story of the world of appearances or something like that further, is that idea that the mind of God took seriously was that, you know, that tiny mad idea is just this idea that logically doesn't make any sense. And it's, what if there was something other than what is? Or what if something was against what is? Or what if there was something other than the truth? The mind went like this and went like, shit, basically, like, which in some, it basically, the mind being, you know, yourself, a creator of, you know, projecting thoughts or something like this, basically, it took this idea seriously, and that would look like viruses, and that would look like miscommunication, and, you know, parents that don't treat their kids right, and bodies that are vulnerable, and innocent children ready to be traumatized, you know, meaningless, a world of meaningful meaninglessness, mm-hmm. almost, you know. And so the Course calls that a tiny mad idea, and it says that have the mind having taken that idea seriously, it didn't want to hear the truth come to it and tell it, hey, there's nothing true in reality other than the truth, mm-hmm. everything else is not true. Like, there's only truth here, because mm-hmm. it identified with something else. It felt like when the truth was trying to tell it, hey, everything's all right, there's no problem in reality. Again, this is a metaphysics. The Course doesn't say you should believe this. It says it's easy to actively resist it, but that you can see if it has effect. So the Course says that when the truth came in to try to correct the mind that identified with this idea felt like the truth was trying to destroy what it identifies with, being a, you know, an individualized ego for a short while, and that, you know, my pains are real. How dare you say that I'm, you know. So what I am identified with is I am a problem solver and a problem maker and a problem solver. And the Course says the ego in that moment created the world of appearances or time, as a place, this is so harsh in some ways, but as a place where God can enter not.
Can
enter not.
Enter not.
The ego created the world of time and space as a place where the truth could enter not. Because it felt like it would be annihilated if it did such a thing. And so that is it's sort of a, you know, it's like I said, it's kind of harsh towards, you know, the world we seem to live in. But then there's a little bit of there's sort of an intermediate, what is it? Okay, so the truth is true and only the truth is true. The basics of the Course is that's it. That's the basic map. And all there is, the only map there is there's just truth and reality. And then a little, like, different map is there's different types of, there's happy dream and unhappy dream. Unhappy dream is where all the stuff is symbolizing and reminding you of your guilt or something like, or of your pain or your problem somehow. You know, for instance, the Course says whatever issues people have with their parents is just a symbol with your feeling that you hurt the world of God, that you separated you messed up all of reality. You think you did. You think God kicked you out because you said, "What if I did something?" And he was. You think he's mad at you, or you think he or it. You think the creator. You think you don't have a creator. You think you're separate from your creator. Mm-hmm. To think that you don't. You know. So, anyways, the you know, like in Buddhism, craving and aversion, sort of like stuff. You know, like the stuff makes us like I need it and I hate it. And then the course's path is, as you know, in your mind, the stuff makes you go like, ah.
So it's like daily challenges that get you to sort of test these sort of concepts.
Yeah, yeah,
in
yeah.
reality, uh-huh. And it's really challenging.
Yeah, yeah. It, as like if something comes up, like in the realm of normally body, money, relationships, the course says among many tools, but the basic thing is to see if you can give it to. Trust to trust, like, give it to the spirit. It doesn't really say it in those words. Give it to the spirit. It does say those words. I think that requires a lot more explanation than just that, which would take a little while. But when I notice I have a thing in my mind, I noticed I was at a service project. It was 3 weeks, and I couldn't wait to get out of it. And it was really hard work, and there was a lot of communication problems going on there. And the guy I was with was, of course, a miracles guy too. And I was like, "You ever feel like you just can't wait till something's over?" You know, I was like, "I can't wait till this is over." He's like, "Yeah, why don't you just trust the..." I know this sounds cliche, but see if the spirit will take that from you. So I was like, "Hey, yo, trust." In my mind, I was like, "Will you take this from me? Like, this idea that I can't wait till this is over? Like, I'm beating myself up with this. I can't wait till this is over, man. I can't wait till this is over." And funny enough, see, this is the use of the spirit through, like, images in my mind. And very playful. In my mind came cartoon Jesus, actually. And he was like... this is a really cool kind of... beautiful parable. He ran away because I say, I like to say, "Hey, trust, I'm going to trust you. By giving to trust, I'm going to gain trust. When you give trust to trust, you gain in trust. Not in the specific thing, but in trust, trusting trust." So right away, this like cartoon Jesus came in my mind, and he was like, "Yo, bro, this already is over." And he was like, "This is an overview." And I was like, "All right." In my mind, I was like, "I've heard that's true, but like, is that really?" Because the Course in Miracles says that all of time, is the script is written. It says it was, you know, it says that, like, we think time's like a spaghetti noodle, like this, and we think we're in the middle of it. But the Course is kind of trying to get us, like, let's say that it's a spaghetti noodle. It's trying to get us to take it and realize that it's actually one thing. Mm-hmm. It's not actually spread out. So he's saying this is over. This is an overview. And I was like, I know the Course says that, and some physics call that the pre-baked loaf of bread. They say that we're just in a slice that's already been baked, and we're going to the next. They say the universe is a pre-baked loaf of bread. This is a theory, and the Course in Miracles sort of has that theory. And Jesus, in this cartoon version in my mind, was
reiterating that fact.
And I was like, "Yeah, is that true?" He goes, "It don't matter, man." He goes, "It don't matter, man. Pull up the pretend popcorn. Enjoy the show." So I was like, it just was so like relieving. I was like, "Oh yeah, like pull up the pretend popcorn." And I just started laughing, you know. There's been a lot of little experiences like that. Anyways, that's, I guess, an interesting little overview of A Course in Miracles.
Yeah, I'm going to have to watch that a couple times to let it sink in, because that one's like...
There's a lot of information.
I guess just one more question I want to ask you about, and we can get back into like the other ayahuasca stuff. So I know after that you got into the Santo Daime. I think mm-hmm. that's like a whole conversation we can have and make a podcast about Santo Daime tradition and your experiences there with ayahuasca. You told me a story once of how you went to go live with some homeless people for a little while. Homeless people, maybe that's not the right way to call them, but people who were living out under a bridge somewhere.
Yeah.
What was that like? If someone invited you to go? Like, yeah, whoa, yeah, yeah. Can you just tell me a bit about that? Cause like, it just blew my mind.
Yeah,
it almost made me want to like go with you and see what it would be like.
Yeah. Yeah, I have a very good friend who, you know, like you said, like, should you even call him that? He's such a smart person, and he's so like out of this world weird that he's such a gift, but like, you gotta really be careful. I can't like introduce him to everybody because he's too weird, you know, in wonderful ways. So we were one time arguing on a street, me and him, actually pretty intensely, and anytime we've gotten arguments with him, it's gotten really intense, but then afterwards it's really miraculous somehow. And we were sitting on the side of the street. It was after a really long argument. And this homeless guy came up to us, and he said, he goes, "You got any money for homeless?" And this guy, my friend, looked up to him, and he goes, "Brother, are you native to this place?" Because he was a Native American. He goes, "Brother, are you native to this place?" He's like, "Yeah." He's like, "And you're gonna call yourself homeless while you walk around on your home?" He's like, "How dare you?" He's homeless himself, my friend, you know. Okay. He's like, "You are not homeless. You may not have any walls, but you are not homeless. You cannot be homeless." And the guy's like, "Oh yeah, man, sorry." Anyways, so this guy has like a really interesting, unique perspective on that. And so like, it's something that I would like to do again here and there, but not the way for him. It's like
a way of
calling or something. And
So what encouraged you to go out and try? He invited you? He challenged you? Was it
He was always like, "Bro, come live with me under the bridge, man." He's like, "We'll have a good time." And it was a good time. It was really messed up in some ways, too.
What was it like? Yeah. What was the experience like?
Well, like, it was like lots of things. I got stuck there in a way that I didn't expect. Like, it would be really complicated to explain what it would require a lot, but like, money disappeared. Flight disappeared, and I was like, shit, like, I might be stuck here for a long time. And so that was kind of...
Were you living in Toronto all the time?
I was, but I was visiting him in Boulder, actually.
Colorado.
That's... I went to be homeless, and then I got stuck there.
He almost became it.
Yeah, yeah, it was much longer than I expected. And
like, how was I getting food, sleeping, were you cold? Like, the basic questions anyone would want to ask is like,
yeah,
how did you survive? It's almost like when people ask me, how do I get my protein from eating vegetables all the time?
Yeah.
You know, like, it's probably just a stupid question. It's like, how did you survive? Well, was it easy? Was it challenging? What?
There's a lot of, like...
Because you're giving up a lot of comforts.
Yeah. There's a lot of good food available for us, though, that's for sure. At least in Boulder, there was a lot of good food available for us. I slept under bridges on cold cement near people who were either on crack or meth, and making weird noises at night. But those were actually some quite miraculous meditative experiences, to tell you the truth. Like, one of the easiest kind of parables to share from that time was that there was a certain Course in Miracles lesson that I was doing, and it was 3 times a day, 10 minutes. You think of a way that the world appears. You say these few sentences that are really well written, I'm sure.
Magic spells.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. S-P-E-L-L, spelling, right? And then you think of a way that the world appears anyway. And I remember I thought of this girl holding a tray at a Olive Garden, and like, I was witnessing her from behind, and I thought of the fact that those people have wheat on their plates and they're actually like allergic to gluten, and that meat was killed, and that girl's nervous, and you know, that girl's excited, she got a tip, and that guy is like, can't wait to get off work, and you know, these people, it's their first date, and all the... So it says to think of a way that the world appears and all the thoughts that come with it, you know. These walls are keeping out the cold, the heat costs gasoline, you know. Try to think of all the thoughts that are compatible with a way that the world appears, and then put it in its own bubble and have it be its own one thing. This is how the Course kind of talks about it. And then in your meditation, go underneath it and realize that there's a door of light underneath it. This is all kind of metaphoric, you know, sort of poetic. And then you, it says, as you see this door, notice you feel it pulling you. You pause, excited at the fact that you're going home. And it was kind of a cold day and stuff, but I would be, you know, experientially, like, in heaven for those 2 minutes, you know. There'd be not any problem would be experienced by me.
So you could escape that whole situation
easily. And it's not that it was all terrible, like, compared to other like, I was having a great time in some ways. But
was it freeing to not have any responsibility, any bills, any phone? Did you have a phone?
I did have a phone.
Your phone, okay.
It was freeing in some ways, but I used that meditation throughout the night because it was going to be cold and I was going to be slipping on the cement. That I told myself, I was like, anytime I woke up by the people being weird or by the cold, I'll just remember, oh, this is a way the world appears. It has these thoughts of like, are those people going to hurt me? Or it has this way of this world appearing, has these thoughts of, I could be vulnerable to this, or what if I'm too cold, or something like that. And then, even, you know, my body would be feeling cold, really, and I'd go underneath it. And it was such a beautiful night that night. Like, the whole night, I kept being triggered by the cold and these very weird sounds these people were making, and kept turning it into a reason to rest in God, you know, in some ways, or in a realm of, like, pure radiant light without any distinctions, you know, or something. No, you know, it's just like there's no stopping it.
And how long does this whole experience last? Not the meditation, like the whole time you're out in Boulder.
I think I was there for like 14 days, and it turned out that I became really close with. There's a Course in Miracles group there too, so I was kind of intermixing with the homeless folks. My friend Asia, who has a program called Presentville, where you become a character in this game, and I was kind of actually helping her with homelessness. There's a character that I was playing for her in, as a homeless character in some ways. It's kind of interesting to talk about. I mean, it could go in so many wacky ways, you know. But then there's a really cool course. It's probably one of my favorite Course in Miracles communities there because it's just playful and fun. Earl Purdy, if you want to type in Earl Purdy into YouTube. It kind of wraps the course, and so I was kind of in and out of it. It was on the streets some night, staying at these really fancy Course in Miracles people's house, and they just loved the fact that I was there. They were like, "The fact that you're here, we're gonna go to this concert now," and they took me to this big concert at Red Rock. It was really.
So are you saying you're just like surrendering to the flow?
Yeah,
like
kind of
allowing things to happen. Yeah, and just, it was an overall
great experience.
Great experience. What was the one takeaway about, like, that you say that sort of stuck with you? Was there any one thing, like a realization that changed perspective around anything of experience life like that?
No, one thing. I don't know if there's just something that came to mind when it comes to those folks. I would say just to be honest, like 70 to 80% of them are highly traumatized and highly undeveloped. So sometimes my mind would think about solutions, you know, to things, because I see like, oh, poor fellow. And sometimes they'd be so. There was one day that I was crying like a lot, you know. I was just like walking through this park, like, oh, actually, that sounds weird, but that's the truth. And it reminds me of the book that you gave me when you first met Siddhartha. You know, his character kind of was like just like, ah. But this girl said, I happened to see these homeless folks. I knew they were. And my friend would say, don't call them homeless, call them home free, or something like that. But I was like, do y'all know where the food's today? And she was like, oh, honey, come here. And she gave me a hug, and she's like, now open your hand. And she put a 20 in my hand. And I was like, no, no, no. She's like, I'm not taking that back. It's yours. She's like, poor, you know?
She gave you 20 bucks.
Yeah, like, and like, it was really weird because, like, I want to give people the opportunity to give, and she loved giving. But I also know that in some big way, like, just my mind alone isn't stuck here. And her mind sort of is in some way, you know, like, so it was really odd to, like, to deal with, like, do I really, am I, you know, how do I not take from this? I don't want to take anything from this woman, you know? Mm-hmm. I know I'm not starving. I can fast for a long ass time, mm-hmm. you know? And so my mind sort of thought, like, how to deal with that dynamic, like, consciously, how to create with that dynamic. I think in some way this sounds weird, but there's something, I think maybe the caste system of India can be enlightened, that you could think about the poor people as having a position of like when I went to India for a little bit, I just was in one place, Rishikesh, and the beggars they took an oath of poverty. So it's not like you could do better. It's like, no, this is what I've promised. Mm-hmm. Like, we think, oh, everybody should be able to become what they want, but just to be honest and work, it doesn't work. It's not workable for them. Mm-hmm. They have to have a position. Society could create a caring position for them. When I was in India, and those beggars were wearing the orange everywhere, and they'd have their bowls, whether I gave them food or not, or money or not, they'd smile and say some Hari Krishna 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 Hari Hari Om Hari, you know, and their position was one, for me at least, that they were like beams of light all over the place. Mm. And I was there for a month, and there was two crabby ones, I remember, but they were all, and within a week I was like, I love these smiling orange people everywhere. You know, and there's something, I don't know if that is a takeaway, but there's something, I think, practically to that, you know, giving these people a spiritual position. They wish that they were Burning Manners, all those people.
So I guess my last question was, like, from a happiness perspective, did people seem happy, unhappy, carefree, upset? Like, I know there's certain, was it a mix of both?
A mix.
Any
sometimes different sometimes really stupid, like the types of fighting that would go on, it'd be like I don't know, like it'd be a little bit, like, I felt bad. I was embarrassed for them. Mm-hmm. But there's a few people who were hyper intelligent, like here and there. And my friend is definitely that. Mm-hmm. He's like one of the smartest persons I know. And there was a few other people there too. There was beautiful heartfelt things. One time we were in this homeless guy's tent. It was really odd. And he said that he was going to go to some acronym organization. I was like, what's that? And he says, it's to help us with our, you know, homeless people with our problems. And then my friend goes, my friend, he sits so proud all the time. He's like, there are no problems. There are only situations. And then the guy who said, like, it's up for us to deal with our problems, he was like, oh, yeah, I mean, like, you know, our situations, you know. I don't know if that answers your question exactly.
It's okay. It works, yeah. So we're going to wrap up for today.
You asked me about happiness in general.
You want to touch on that?
I guess we barely mentioned, like, the thing that everybody's annoyingly mentioning all the time, the pandemic. We barely mentioned at the beginning, but, you know, like, pandemonium, hysteria, and fear is contagious or viral. And perhaps happiness is too, literally. You know, I think it is. Like, I've been spreading this. It's been contagious. Maybe we could talk more about that another time. But anyways, you asked me about happiness in regards to that, and I just thought, I just want to say that, like, somehow, like, playfully, I go around when I'm not, like, on full play, but, like, I have this idea that I'm, like, I look around at the people as I walk, and I walk, I'm like, oh, shit, y'all don't even know. Like, a surprise is about to happen. Like, that's the vibe I tried to give, you know, if not more, but at mm-hmm. least that, like, oh, y'all don't even know. Oh, my God, like, Buddha's about to appear, you know, or something. Anyways,
I love it, man. I love it. Joey, do you have a social media account? Anything where people can follow you? I don't know how much you're promoting your social networks these days. Anything you want to share for people to?
I'm Heart Hiker on Facebook. I do have a website. It has nothing. JoeyInTheJourney.com. I have a YouTube, and it has some interviews and stuff like that. But I don't even know how to find that. I mean, like, it's kind of got
start with Facebook.
There's more stuff happening.
Cool.
If you want to look up Heart Hiker, that's the easiest way to probably get a hold of me.
So check out Joe. He's a great guy, great heart, inspiring to me in many ways, how he fearlessly expresses himself and puts himself out there. He's had all these incredible and interesting life experiences, which we'll talk more about in more detail in a future podcast. So thank you guys so much for tuning in.
Thank you, Giovanni. Giovanni is awesome, bro. First time I met him, giving me the Siddhartha book and so many good adventures. Thank you, Giovanni.
Thanks, brother. So yeah, thanks, guys. If you like this video, share, like, comment, or not, whatever you guys prefer. No pressure. I love you guys. Thank you so much. Be well, and we'll see you soon. Peace.